Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Urban Studies. My name is Peter Christian Eigner, your host. And today we have the pleasure of talking with Carl Nightingale about his new book, Segregation, A Global History of Divided Cities. Carl, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
The book is a monumental feat, hugely ambitious. Why don't you tell us about how you came to the project and a little bit about yourself?
I grew up in the United States. And when you grow up in the United States, you're keenly aware of the color line in cities. I was especially keenly aware of it because I grew up, well, in the suburbs. I grew up on a college campus in faculty housing, and my backyard ended at a fence. Beyond the fence was a little neighborhood that was 100% African-American, mostly the parents and families of people who worked in large houses on the other side of the tracks, the classic designation of the color line. Well, the fence was always a curiosity, and the fact that the color line was so clear always brought up questions for me as I was growing up. And the obvious ones are there: why was I in a big house on one side and they were living in the small houses on the other side? Why was the fence there? Of course, why did it seem like there was such a so much racial inequality? And I can't say that the fence immediately created this book, it certainly created the questions that have been center at the heart of it, which is basically why do these things exist, and why is there inequality at the same time?
So, right, you had written your first book was on the subject as well, right?
My first book was on the lives of kids growing up in what we then called inner city neighborhoods or poor neighborhoods of Philadelphia, and that did allow me to kind of go across the fence and actually live on the other side for 6 years or so and get to know a lot of young people and all the struggles that they went through contending with this huge gap in our society.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a sadly enduring subject of interest. Now, most scholars have sort of studied segregation in isolation. What's stand out about this book is you take a really global approach. You argue that coercive segregation spread around the world because it was interconnected, that intellectual networks, governments, businesses were crucial to the rise of the West in the modern era and therefore crucial to the spread of segregation. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the argument of the book is that unfortunately segregation has been with us really since the beginning of cities. I often quip that it's the original sin of urban planning because it actually goes back to ancient times when the first settlements that we really are unified about as calling cities, the big cities of Sumer and southern Mesopotamia. And even the ones in northern Mesopotamia were all based on the idea that of spatial inequality, that spatial inequality could help hierarchical societies and help people in power to extend their power, to control resources, and to basically control this sort of the ideas of the society. So monumental architecture was all about creating the idea of divine right, authoritarian monarchs, and they essentially created a place for the gods or the god kings. It was above and elevated in a kind of celebratory way above the masses of people who lived in the dustier wards below. That general idea has been implemented in various different ways, even in Mesopotamia in various different ways, but over the years, over the centuries and millennia since, various different configurations. And one of the amazing things about segregation is that it's been able to persist in part because it takes so many different forms. That sort of divine versus mortal form is only one. But cities, from the very beginning, have also defined cities versus the countryside, for example, by using walls and other monumental architecture. They've also had places in them for people who were from far away, the strangers versus the locals. That's another really key and very ancient form of segregation that was often used by the rulers to keep in control, because they could always use the foreigners as scapegoats if they were, especially if they were spatially concentrated, make them into targets of local violence and so on. Riots against foreigners are a common theme all the way out through urban history, and segregation helped that happen. The worst version of that kind of nasty trick was the Jewish ghettos of the medieval Europe, where Jews were set aside and as opposed to being expelled from the city, often because they were useful to the local regime to kind of control society. But none of those systems before this period involved the question of race. Race is a very relatively modern idea. The word itself is from medieval, but it didn't really come into political prominence until the 18th century. But it was racial segregation that became the most important form of segregation for the expanding West. It was by means of creating and propagating segregated cities by color and race that the big empires of the modern era, Britain, France, and the United States especially, were in part able to expand. It was a very important tool in their kit for expanding their influence. So how did they do it? Yes, you mentioned three things that are very important. Governments. Obviously, these are the empires. The empires had a stake in these cities, both in terms of for everything that cities are good for, but they also, they had a stake in these cities promoting their rule. And one way they could do that was to create these separate towns. The idea of white towns and black towns came up first in 1700. It was based on a kind of a format that already existed among colonial cities, European colonial cities in Asia, and to some degree in the Americas as well, where an empire would come with its officials, merchants, whoever they were, and they would set up in one section of the town that was superior to the rest of the town, and kind of use that superior perch to kind of give justification to their presence and their dominance. But they weren't called white town and black town until 1700, and that was kind of the beginning of this idea that color could be the main form of separation. So governments were very involved in that, and they kind of invented this idea for a whole variety of due to a couple of very complicated circumstances that we can talk about later. The other important people, as time went on, were various kinds of professional intellectuals, experts, urban reformers, people who developed increasing ties with each other across the world, and who were interested in segregation for a whole variety of reasons, starting with public health, moving on to housing issues, moving on to just kind of the general idea of urban planning. Each in turn found reasons for segregation to be a critical component of how a city was laid out. So this is racial segregation. And then finally there's the real estate industry, which in some ways was a little bit of you never quite count on the real estate industry in many cases, because on the one hand, there was this, the real estate industry came with all kinds of tools with which to divide cities, including things like restrictive covenants, land use covenants, and so on, from very early on in the 18th century. On the other hand, it also came with the idea of private property rights, and that meant that if you created a segregated city in, say, Asia or Africa, and there were many wealthier African nations living in that city, they had the right to buy anywhere, and that meant that sometimes the white town, black town border would actually be a little bit less strict than the authorities would have liked. On the other hand, they really couldn't fight back against it a lot of times, because they depended on these African or Asian elites to be loyal and they depended on that loyalty to keep their empire in place. So it was, segregation often was a little bit tricky for them to implement. And so many colonial cities, while there's a kind of legal idea that there should be divided, or a kind of official idea that they should be divided, the reality is not always exactly as the ruling regime would like. So there's that's the three big institutions to start off with that really created the modern form of segregation.
Yeah, there's this a popular impression out there, I think, that segregation is sort of ancient. Mm-hmm. You know, even by talking about Mesopotamia, these things, the idea is that you make a point in the introduction, people will distinguish between voluntary or de facto segregation and de jure segregation. But you're, in this global context, you're arguing that really there's often no big difference between those two things.
That's right. I think the distinction between voluntary segregation and involuntary one, it's often the main thing that people have in their mind is that, okay, people come into a city, they come from a similar place out from, you know, some similar place elsewhere. They have a similar language and they have a similar culture, and it differs from the place that they've come to. So they gather together and they form, you know, what's called an entry neighborhood, a vestibule neighborhood, port of entry, what do you want to call it? And that this is an okay way of segregating because they've chosen that form. There are a couple issues with that, and probably they go to the basic distinction between what's segregated and what's not, which I think is not an easy thing to really work out. But the main thing is that, first of all, voluntary segregation, the forced segregation is in some sense voluntary segregation. When you create forced segregation, when somebody forces segregation on a city, they want to do it. They have the power to do it, and they end up doing it. And so that's as voluntary as it gets. So to just call all voluntary segregation good loses the fact that all segregation has a voluntary element to it, and especially the worst kinds. The second thing is that when ethnic groups do kind of coalesce, first of all, they may have the power to actually come together and join close, live close by, but they don't necessarily, and often don't actually, have very much power to exclude others. And so, unlike what we could classically think of as forced segregation, these ethnic neighborhoods are often, you know, they may predominate, say, Polish or Italian, and they have 30%, 40%, but there's still 60 or 70% of people who are, not Polish and not Italian in those neighborhoods. And, you know, it's not even clear that that's the main goal of these ethnic concentrations, just to exclude other people. Ironically, in the United States, not ironically, it sort of proves the point that in the United States, it wasn't until the federal government and the real estate industry and reformers, the three big institutions, got together to create a system of segregation that privileged whites, that white ethnic groups were actually able to keep blacks out of that neighborhood. Those neighborhoods had substantial populations of African Americans spread across the city. So it really took a very serious and very much voluntary. It was something that people wanted, and something that people had power to do, and it was something that people actually believed in and then actually implemented. That, to me, is the definition of voluntary segregation, and that system is the force system that ultimately created our black-white divides.
Right, so we've already talked a little bit about, or hinted that intellectuals play a key role here, but among these three groups that we've started with, you argue that governments are the most important, right, that you've hinted at this, and we can talk more about this later, but there are some scholars who argue since the rise of segregation takes place against the backdrop of these much larger developments of the rise of the West and the rise of capitalism and those other things, that markets or market capitalism, real estate, other things are key vectors for segregation. But you argue that actually the color lines that's set up by real estate agents and other industries are often porous intentionally and not, mm-hmm. that it is neither capitalism by function is neither colorblind nor inherently segregationist, but governments, you argue, are the most important of these city splitting institutions historically.
I think that's right. Historically, certainly to get to divide the sheer numbers of colonial cities that across Asia, Africa, even western parts of North America, Australia, all those really took a huge amount of government agency. And I should qualify that it's not always that governments are passing laws to create these divided cities. They're using a variety of different coercive means in addition to law. In fact, the law and legislation wasn't used as a segregated device really effectively until the late 19th century. And some might even argue that by creating legal forms, you actually make segregation weaker, or at least more vulnerable to attack. In some cases, I think that was also true. That's why a lot of colonial governments didn't want to pass laws, precisely because they could get segregation in other ways. But governments, I think, they spearheaded the move. They also eventually provided the power that intellectuals needed when they were proclaiming the need for segregated cities. Sometimes these intellectuals worked within government, sometimes they worked outside of it, often back and forth. But they ultimately required a government force to do that. And things like the British Empire's policy, segregate African cities because they thought that this would keep malaria from infecting the colonial officials. Those are official policies, and they were very, very effective and very important in segregating cities all across. That's not to say, though, that the other two forms of institutions aren't important. I think the next, when you talk about governments, the obvious next step is, well, what about markets? Are these things, is there a market interest in these kinds of things? And the answer is very, very mixed. When you look at the various different kinds of capitalist interests that that surface in cities during the modern era, mercantile capitals were the first ones. And they had, on one hand, the first segregated city was run by a mercantile company, the British East India Company. On the one hand, their main point was to have a port there and a place where they could gather good goods, and so they could buy goods from this area and then ship them away. And that's why they needed this concentrated zone of human contact. And in a sense, what they really wanted was as many Asians as possible to live as close as possible to where they were. On the other hand, they also knew that those Asians could pose a threat. So if they wanted their city to stay in place, they needed a certain wall. So ultimately, it was about creating a zone of agglomeration, bringing people together. But it was also a way of pulling at the same time that you push, a kind of push me, pull you kind of situation that they created. Elsewhere, though, for example, the British government in Nigeria really wanted separate districts for whites and blacks, but the British merchants who lived in those cities were very much opposed to those arrangements and wanted to be close as possible to their clients, intermediaries, so on and so forth. So they were often against it. Gigantic industrial capitalist firms wanted their workers to get to the factory on time. They didn't necessarily want buffer zones that the workers had to cross that could often get them there late. In Johannesburg, for example, they created various different forms of segregation that were more attuned to the needs of working, getting their workers close by. The gold mines, for example, in Johannesburg had same-sex, same-race compounds where the black workers would live. But the other businesses in town were opposed to sending all the black inhabitants of town to a location that was 15 kilometers away on a rather poorly maintained train line because the workers never came into town. So they often would buck the segregationists. So you can see there's no real clear consensus on that side. The real estate industry is the place where ultimately the racial segregation and capitalist interests eventually came to be more aligned, but only in certain kinds of societies. In societies like British India, where, as I've already mentioned, there are Indians with vast amounts of money who could very well easily buy houses in Whitetown and certainly did on a regular basis. It wasn't really great to have a law that said it would have been impossible to pass a law that said you can't live there, though they tried in various different places and got tremendous pushback. On the other hand, in a place like South Africa or the United States, where the white residents are there permanently, again, unlike the white residents in say, Calcutta or Bombay, the white residents are there permanently and they want to invest in real estate. And they want their generations to inherit this real estate. There, the idea that that Africans or African Americans could bring down the value of the surrounding property by moving into a white neighborhood, that caught on in a very big way. And what that did was to create a kind of market, a racialized market incentive. That is, the value of the property had a racial component to it. And when she did that, then you created a market dynamic that was very, very powerfully segregationist, like elsewhere. And so that's really why I think it kind of underlays the segregation we have today in the United States, that basic idea, which is something that's impossible to legislate against. You can't tell white people, don't believe that black people are going to bring your property values down. And in fact, what's going on there really in those cases is that property values are going down because whites leave thinking that their neighbors are going to believe that, in fact, their property values are going down. It's kind of average opinion about what the average opinion is going to be that causes this to happen. And once they flee, they create less demand and for the neighborhood. And once the demand goes down, the price actually does go down. Housing. So it's a real devilish, kind of dynamic, and it's very, very hard to stop.
Right. Well, so your story takes us around the world, and you have this argument that there's a sort of a line that we can trace from region to region, following these ideas and these practices. So why don't you take us through some of that?
Okay, yeah. So this is kind of an interesting trajectory, because when we think of racism, we usually think of kind of slavery in the Atlantic world, the Western world, and to some degree, that's certainly accurate. That racism and race had tremendous impact on the Western world, but as far as the cities go, it's actually during that slavery actually created an impetus away from segregation. There had been some segregation in places like Mexico that had been ordered by the King of Spain. That began to disintegrate when you got slaves moving in, mostly because you needed to control those slaves in a much more intense way than you could if you had them in a separate neighborhood. If you put them in a separate neighborhood, slavery was not going to last long. Slaves would use that enforced closeness to mount all kinds of rebellions, and your whole system would go down quickly. So the slavery regimes really started from the beginning to legislate that people, that their slaves need to live in the houses of the wealthiest people, that is, the slave owners, not separate from them. So there, right there is a big, huge area where segregation took a lot longer to come. It took a lot longer to come to South Africa, slave society, and the United States, ironically, than it did to everywhere else. So where did it really happen? Well, it really started, as I've already implied, in Asia and in the East. And it was in a complicated relationship with ideas about color and race that were in the process of forming in the Atlantic world. But when it came to actually dividing a city and then calling one side white town and one side black town, that was only plausible in Asia, where the vast bulk of the population was free and where slavery was not as much of a major part of the economy. It was an important part of the economy, not the central part. And where, as I said, this kind of push-me-pull-you dynamic between mercantile companies and their Indian intermediaries who took place, whether we're nervous about Indian armies, whether the demographic regime was quite different from in the Americas, where there's very small numbers of white settlers and gigantic and increasing urban populations, as opposed to the Americas, where the local populations declined. All of these things led for a very different kind of politics of the kind of urban encounter, if you want to call it that. And in those places, that's when it really got going. So the idea of race was then applied to this color scheme as time went on, especially in the British Empire first. Once the British began conquering India, they really began what I call the first surge of racial segregation, where they created 175 they called stations. You could also call them the stations of the British Empire. These very small military civil bases, administrative bases, often a couple miles outside of the main cities of India when they would conquer them. And these spread from Afghanistan down to the Malay Peninsula, 175 of these. And that's kind of the first surge, mostly about an imperial administration again. So there's a government really pushing hard, though questions of real estate came in, the market came in, and definitely questions of sanitation, public health also came in. Then the next big surge came because Western empires, led by Britain again, wanted to get in access to the Chinese market. And the way they did that first, the British first set up Singapore to rival the Dutch so they could get into the East India's China Seas, South China Seas, East China Seas. Then they launched this notorious campaign to flood China with opium that led to war in the 1830s and 40s that opened up Chinese ports. And when they did that, they encountered other traditions of segregation that had been in existence in China. And the Chinese emperor and the British negotiated to create this kind of concession system where there would be these British and French and other international concessions inside Chinese cities. That also opened up another kind of another segregationist dynamic that came because the treaties allowed more Chinese people to move outside of China, and they began to flood across the Pacific Rim to various different gold mining towns at first, and then to other cities that came up in the wake of that. And in those areas, there was a different dynamic where Chinese migrants were running up against white settlers who were coming in equal surges towards these shores, of demographic surges, and where whites try to, often in cases, to launch violent attacks against the Chinese populations. Chinese populations tended then to defensively gather in certain parts of the city, creating the first Chinatowns, some of them, the largest Asian cities outside of China, most importantly San Francisco. And so that was kind of the third, I lumped this all together as this kind of the second surge, this opening of China that created segregation cities in Southeast Asia as well as around the Pacific Rim. And then in the 1890s, things went really kind of haywire when the plague first came to Hong Kong, one of these Chinese it was a British city that was very much one of the most segregated towns in Asia. But the plague came to an area of Hong Kong that was largely Chinese, and the Chinese got more or less became known as the vector for plague, and were seen as the main threat that whites faced living in that city. And so the word segregation for the first time actually got used at this point for the practice of taking plague victims and putting them into various different kinds of divided or separated areas. We hear that.
And this had to do with the fact that we have these large populations that are workforces, and they're often crowded into these slums. And this is part of a larger problem with the mass urbanization, right? That these places become known as dens of disease because there's no sanitation system or anything else to sort of public, any sort of public health control, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a global phenomenon. You rightly point out that, you know, the creation of slums in working class districts is a pan-Western, pan-imperial phenomenon of this time. The only difference in the case of Hong Kong is that the vocabulary of race could give you completely free rein in a place like Hong Kong, whereas back in London, you know, you might call the working class districts the darkest England and various different other kind of racial terms for it.
Referring to where the Irish lived.
The Irish, yeah. Exactly. So this language was very translatable into back and forth between a kind of class or a race politics. It's not really clear exactly where one began and one ended. But a place like Hong Kong, really created a sense that, you know, it's the Asians, it's the non-Westerners who are creating problems. We need to segregate them and not just spread like wildfire, because the plague, they had no idea why the plague was there. They had no idea about the flea vector or the rat vector at the time. They discovered it in Hong Kong, but it took a while. And so they started doing, things that basically made the plagues spread even further, including scaring all the residents of a place like Hong Kong or Bombay by forcing them into segregation camps. When that happened, people would just leave the city. When they left the city, they'd take the plague with them, and the countryside would get even worse off. Things like that. It was a disaster of a public health campaign. But everywhere the plague and these rats and the fleas went, so did the idea of segregation. So it went eastward towards across the Pacific to Honolulu. San Francisco had, you know, yet another attempt at a segregation ordinance around 1900. Went westward throughout India, into South Africa, where the plague was the first main reason why British authorities there began to divide places like Johannesburg and Durban and Cape Town, and then West Africa, and then even the logic of this all translated into other diseases. So the malaria in West Africa was a clear pretext for segregationism, and then in places like Baltimore, which passed the first segregation ordinance in the United States in 1910, the first segregation ordinance on the East Coast of the United States in 1910, that was tuberculosis, and the fear of tuberculosis coming out of black neighborhoods was a major factor in the campaigns for that legislation. So that's what I call segregation mania. It was just fear of disease, not knowing how diseases really spread, but basically coming to a kind of racialized theory of the spread and then creating segregation. Meanwhile, also, the urban planning movement was beginning to develop, and planners were professionalizing. And they too wanted just cities to be more sanitized, but they had other ideas in mind as well. Including, you know, how do you develop a beautiful capital for Western empires in places like Africa and Asia? And the two classic examples of their contribution to the spread of segregation, I call it a fourth surge, the surge of segregation that's related to various kinds of planning devices. Would be cities like Rabat in Morocco or New Delhi in India, where planners deliberately set out divided cities. Often in case of like New Delhi, it was a very, 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 very elaborate 5 or 6 zone system for various different ranks as well as colors of people. In Rabat, it was clearly creating a whole new town that would show off how great European Western urban planning was in comparison to the Arab Medinas and their very narrow, convoluted street patterns and the building that made commerce very difficult and so on and so forth. So the idea was, okay, we'll create these beautiful cities outside the existing Indian or African Arab cities, and those cities will show how advanced the West is versus how sort of stuck in the midst of time. Beautiful, sure, you know, brilliant in many ways, but definitely stuck in the past. These other Eastern or, you know, West African civilizations were. So that's number four. And then the fifth is really what creates apartheid in South Africa and segregation in the United States. And I argue that there's reason to put those two together. Both of them, unlike any other form of racial segregation, actually outlive the massive anti-colonial civil rights black liberation movements of the mid-20th century. They don't only outlive them, but they're still with us today. I mean, apartheid obviously outlived it and eventually died, but now it has its own logic, actually quite similar to the United States, logic in the United States. But the main thing is to include, the reason I include those two together is that they actually have lots of things in common that they both imported, mostly from Britain, but also from other places in Europe. Put themselves into place. And those things include things like restrictive covenants, which were so important, both South Africa and the United States in the early years to kind of become a kind of main tool, a thing that people fought for when they were thinking about people fighting for segregation. There were also zoning laws, which were used very effectively in the United States and South Africa. For racial purposes, even if they weren't always necessarily put into place with like explicitly racial logic. For example, you know, the idea in the United States that only apartment buildings could be zoned out of entire municipalities in the suburbs. This meant that, you know, the renters couldn't come into the suburbs as easily. It meant that African-American renters couldn't come into the suburbs. Public housing and slum clearance policies, both are very, very closely linked. Get rid of the slum, well, okay. Get rid of the slum and put people in public housing, well, which slums are we going to go after and where are we going to put the public housing once we clear the slums to put people in? That's an easily, those two policies in tandem are very easily used to create, you know, racial boundaries in both the U.S. and South Africa. And then ultimately, in some ways, the most important were these very technical, but just enormously important first-time homebuyer mortgage support programs. And these got their initial inspiration in Britain from the Building and Loan Society movement, which tried to create mortgages that were more accessible to working people. Once they were brought to the South Africa and the United States as state programs, they were also used to, you know, to promote white settlement in certain parts of the city. They were also used and to create divestment in other parts of the city, almost, you know, heavily focused on black areas. And the whole redlining maps of the United States, which were so famous and justly, rightly so, came out of, you know, basically a non-racial law that was meant to help people get homes or buy new homes during the Depression, try to stimulate the economy, but which was actually put into place in a very much discriminatory manner, deliberately so, by the Federal Housing Administration in the 1930s and then more importantly in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, early 60s. And which was also copied by the Veterans Administration. Actually, very similar housing policies were also in place in South Africa, and they created the northern suburbs of Johannesburg, for example. They're so famous. So those things were very, very similar. The only big difference, of course, is that in the United States we tried segregation laws, but the African American civil rights movement was able to mobilize against them very early on. In 1917, they had the great victory in Buchanan versus Worley in the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court, you know, declared neighborhood segregation laws unconstitutional. In South Africa, no such thing happened. In fact, just the opposite happened. There were legal precedents. There was no constitutional check against them, and those precedents encouraged segregationists to ask more legislation. And over the course of the early 20th century, they just got more and more and more more complex laws to do more, create more color lines all across the city, across the cities of South Africa, culminating, of course, in the most infamous of all, the Group Areas Act of 1950. So yeah. there you have kind of the overall sweep of how this stuff spread.
The chapters on Chicago and Johannesburg are striking because it goes back to the point you begin with, is that these things take place in all styles of government, and the line between de jure and de facto, however legitimate it is in other circumstances, often at this massive, bird's eye view, makes little sense.
Right. I mean, I think, my opposition to the de jure de facto distinction is mostly has to do with the de facto side. It tends to imagine that, okay, so there's the de jure. Yeah, I can understand that. There's segregation by explicit government regulation, legislation. Sorry, that sounds like de jure to me. But if everything else is de facto, that is, it just happens because it's a fact or because it's there, then that just completely obscures the political power that was arrayed in various different kinds of institutions, not just the government, to put these kinds of things into place. And, to somehow excuse that whole area, I think it does often become an excuse. Oh, it's just de facto. It's okay. Somehow, it's voluntary, or it's just, it's just there. There's no real injustice being committed here. This is kind of innocent. That causes a major, major problem for me. I think we really need to look at segregation of cities in terms of the many institutional vectors in which create them, and the very striking collective power that's put behind these initiatives. So I would say de jure, okay, that helps a little bit, but don't call the rest de facto. It's not just something that sort of automatically appears. We have to make it happen, and people do.
Right. So if segregation is this product, and to a significant degree, of the rise of modern Western colonialism, what does this story tell us for where we are now? You end the book talking about the resistance to this global legacy. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can take us out by talking a little bit about where those movements failed, where they succeeded, and what that's left us with.
Yeah. Well, it's a little dispiriting, but I'll try to end this on an optimistic note as I possibly can. I mean, so the nationalist movements that got rid of the colonial, the formal colonial empires, were obviously they pretty much got rid of the white town, black town tradition that had got started back in 1700. On the other hand, the movements often devolved into authoritarian movements of the elite, or during the Cold War. Outside powers often made sure that the elite gained power, and they, just like their imperial rivals, put into place various different kinds of city splitting schemes that were meant to keep the power of the new elites in place. And so you get dramatic instances of class segregation all across what became known as the Third World, I guess now it's called the very variegated developing world. Real estate interests were certainly a big part of that. So were various kinds of public health campaigns, just like in previous times and so on. There's a lot of recycling of old imperial policies thrown in there. Anyway, you can sort of imagine most of the megacities of the United of the world are located in these developing countries, and most of them are quite deeply and painfully segregated by class. In the United States and South Africa, the opposition movements were very, very powerful, very creative. in South Africa, ultimately, because of its heavy relation, reliance on these legislated measures, like the Group Areas Act. In some ways, they were very, very difficult because, of course, they mobilized a huge amount of armed force to keep them in place. On the other hand, they were also became clear targets. These laws became clear targets, and so ultimately, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa was able to really mobilize a global coalition against apartheid in the 80s, and finally, ended apartheid and forced the Group Areas Act to be canceled. So that was an enormous victory. Unfortunately, in both the United States and South Africa, no matter how powerful the opposition was, there are still gigantic forces at play that continue to split these cities, and the real estate dynamics are probably the most important in both cases. But because the government's still involved, because the government doesn't regulate these things, it doesn't also put the kind of money that would be necessary to kind of bring housing discrimination suits on the sheer quantity that would be necessary to even make a dent in these gigantic divides. And we're also in the United States, in particular, we're retreating from public housing, which doesn't have to be a segregationist policy. It was in the United States most in the middle of the 20th century, but it doesn't have to be. It could be a major way to slow down things like gentrification, to create new integrated communities, to try out different kinds of forms of integration. But that hasn't happened. We completely lost that interest in that. So ultimately, in some ways, as I put at the end of the book, the forces of segregation worldwide are still pretty much, operate the commanding heights of urban politics. We still have the main sources of power in urban space are still there, still in place, and still segregationist. That said, I think we probably know more about how to desegregate cities, how to make them more equal. In our own era than we've ever known since we first started creating cities back in Mesopotamia. I think we do know that that density can be the solution to some of these problems. That things like rope boundaries and so on can keep the disadvantages of segregation at least mitigate them. You may not be able to force white people to invite huge numbers of African Americans to live in their communities, but we can at least create cities that are where the opportunities are more spread out, so that no matter what community you live in, you still have an equal access to jobs, the kind of things that give you a healthy life, to education, to income, and obviously wealth creation, which is so important, So we could do more along those lines. I think we know quite a bit more of how to do that. We're kind of in this bittersweetly paradoxical place as far as segregation goes. We've got a lot of it still. In some ways, we've got it in ways that are very difficult to attack. On the other hand, we know it better than we've known it before. And hopefully that knowledge over time will be able to lead to inspire movements of urban planners, of grassroots activists, academics, of people people who transportation authorities, city governments, national governments, state governments, so on and so forth, in ways that will at least begin to mitigate this very severe effects that continue to be associated with the color line in the United States and everywhere.
Well, reading your book, these lines go everywhere. And, if there is a hope for change in that, I think it's really important work like this that that gives you a sense for how paradoxical and how many different forms it can take and what the common patterns are. It's really quite striking when you take a global view. So what is next on the agenda? Are you planning something similar for your next project? What are you working on now?
Yeah, well, I'm really interested in how these settler societies, which are a subset of all of these various different societies that segregation flourished over the course of the last two centuries. I'm really interested in seeing how these settler societies work more in more detail. I mean, this book, the segregation book, was really an invitation to all kinds of projects, to all kinds of scholars. There's all different kinds of connections, and as you say, the lines go everywhere. Each one of those lines needs further investigation. But the one I'm most interested in pursuing myself is this one about how it was that different settler societies treated their cities in different ways. I'm really interested, for example, I've done a lot on the South African-U.S. comparison, and that'll definitely be part of the project, but I'm interested in, French people settled in Algeria, and they created, definitely a segregated city, but it definitely looks a lot different, and the feel of the rhetoric and so on is very different, and I'd like to understand that better. And then I think that really, really, we all really need to, at this particular moment, one of the places that needs to be really investigated in terms of segregation and where it's been so much part of the political rhetoric now is the Israel-Palestine situation, which is also a settler society, very complex and interesting settler society, where the techniques of segregation and state-run segregation are very, very sophisticated and involve all kinds of new innovations that would have made some of the apartheid engineers, frankly, and definitely some of the segregationists in the United States quite jealous, I would think. And this is, of course, an issue that has been very, very heavily debated in Israel and in the world, whether or not kind of apartheid system is coming into place there. But it strikes me as equally interesting to talk about, how is this system connected to all the others, not whether or not it fits some sort of ideal, typical definition of what apartheid is or segregation is, but just how does it fit into the bigger, broader question of how we use cities for purposes of domination, settlements, occupation, and so on. So those are some of the questions I'll be trying to follow up on in the upcoming years.
Well, I look forward to reading that. That sounds fascinating. I want to thank you again for sitting down with us and talking to us today. I encourage everyone listening to go out and buy the book. Carl, thanks so much. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.